And Christina, she's fine too?
Sure, Peter said, and there was a touch of coolness in his response to the question about his mother. A problem there? He remembered that Walter had complained to him some months before that Christina had become a little moody. But for Ricky, who could remember Peter's parents' generation as teenagers, their problems were always a little fictional. How could people with the world still in front of them have truly serious problems?
You know, he said, we haven't talked like this in ages. Is your father reconciled to your going to Cornell yet?
Peter smiled wryly.
I guess so. I don't think he knows how tough it is to get into Yale. It was a lot easier when he went.
No doubt it was, said Ricky, who had just remembered the circumstances under which he had last had a conversation with Peter Barnes. John Jaffrey's party, the evening on which Edward Wanderley had died.
Well, I guess I'll poke around in the department store for a while, Peter said. Yes, Ricky said,
remembering against his will all the details of that evening. It seemed to him at times that life had darkened since that night, that a wheel had turned.
I guess I'll go now, Peter said, and stepped backward.
Oh, don't let me hold you up, Ricky said.
I was just thinking.
About sidewalks?
No, you scamp.
Peter turned away, smiling and saying goodbye, and strode easily up the side of the square. Ricky spotted Sears James's Lincoln cruising past the Archer Hotel at the top of the square, going as usual 10 miles an hour slower than anyone else, and hurried on his way to Wheat Row. Somberness had not been evaded. He saw again the skeletal branches thrusting through the brilliant leaves, the implacable bloodied face of the girl on the film poster, and remembered that it was his turn to tell the story at the Chowder Society meeting that night. He hastened on, wondering what had become of his high spirits. But he knew. Edward Wanderley. Even Sears had followed them, the other three members of the Chowder Society, into that gloom. He had 12 hours to think of something to talk about.
Oh, Sears, he said on the steps of their building. His partner was just pushing himself out of the Lincoln. Good morning. It's at your house tonight, isn't it?
Ricky, said Sears, at this hour of the morning it is positively forbidden to chirp.
Sears lumbered forward, and Ricky followed him through the door, leaving Milburn behind. Frederick Hawthorne. 1. Of all the rooms in which they habitually met, this was Ricky's favorite. The library in Sears James's house, with its worn leather chairs, tall, indistinct glass-fronted bookcases, drinks on the little round tables, prints on the walls, the muted old Shiraz carpet beneath their feet, and the rich memory of old cigars in the atmosphere. Having never committed himself to marriage, Sears James had never had to compromise his luxurious ideas of comfort. After so many years of meeting together, the other men were by now unconscious of the automatic pleasure and relaxation and envy that they experienced in Sears's library, just as they were nearly unconscious of the equally automatic discomfort they felt in John Jaffrey's house, where the housekeeper, Millie Sheehan, forever bustled in rearranging things. But they felt it, each of them. Ricky Hawthorne, perhaps more so than the others, had wished to possess such a place for himself. But Sears had always had more money than the others, just as his father had had more money than theirs. It went back that way for 5 generations, until you reached the country grocer who had cold-bloodedly put together a fortune and turned the James family into gentry. By the time of Sears's grandfather, the women were thin, palpitating, decorative and useless. The men hunted and went to Harvard, and they all went to Saratoga Springs in the summers. Sears's father had been a professor of ancient languages at Harvard, where he kept a third family house. Sears himself had become a lawyer because, as a young man, he had thought it immoral for a man not to have a profession. His year or so of schoolmastering had shown him that it could not be teaching. Of the rest, the cousins and brothers, most had succumbed to good living, hunting accidents, cirrhosis, or breakdowns. But Sears, Ricky's old friend, had bluffed his way through until, if he was not the handsomest old man in Milburn, that was surely Louis Benedict, he was the most distinguished. But for the beard, he was his father's double, tall and bald and massive, with a round, subtle face above his vested suits. His blue eyes were still very young. Ricky supposed that he had to envy that, too, the magisterial appearance. He himself had never been particularly prepossessing. He was too small and too trim for that. Only his mustache had improved with age, growing somehow more luxuriant as it turned gray. When he had developed little jowls, they had not made him more impressive. They had only made him look clever. He did not think that he was particularly clever. If he had been, he might have avoided a business arrangement in which he was unofficially to become a sort of permanent junior partner. But it had been his father, Harold Hawthorne, who had taken Sears into the firm. All those years ago he had been pleased, even excited, that he would be joined by his old friend. Now, settled into an undeniably comfortable armchair, he supposed that he was still pleased. The years had married them as securely as he was married to Stella, and the business marriage had been far more peaceful than the domestic, even if clients in the same room with both partners invariably looked at Sears and not himself when they spoke. That was an arrangement which Stella would never have tolerated. Not that anyone in his right mind, all through the years of their marriage, would have looked at Ricky when he could have looked at Stella. Yes, he admitted to himself for the thousandth time, he did like it here. It went against his principles and his politics, and probably the Puritanism of his long-vanished religion, too. But Sears's library, Sears's whole splendid house, was a place where a man felt at ease. Stella had no compunctions about demonstrating that it was also the sort of place where a woman, too, could feel at ease. She didn't mind, now and then, treating Sears's house as though it were her own. Thankfully, Sears tolerated it. It had been Stella, on one of those occasions, 12 years ago, coming into the library as if she led a platoon of architects, who had given them their name. "Well, there they are, by God," she had said. "The Chowder Society. Are you going to keep my husband away from me all night, Sears? Or aren't you boys through telling your lies yet?" Still, he supposed it was Stella's perpetual energy and constant needling which had kept him from succumbing to age, as old John Jaffrey had. For their friend Jaffrey was old, despite his being 6 months younger than Hawthorne himself, and a year younger than Sears, and, in fact, only 5 years older than Louis, their youngest member. Louis Benedict, the one who was supposed to have killed his wife, was seated directly across from Ricky, an image of expansive good health. As time rolled through them all, subtracting things, it seemed only to add to Louis. It hadn't been true when he was younger, but these days he bore a definite resemblance to Cary Grant. His chin would not sag, his hair would not fall. He had become almost absurdly handsome. This evening, Louis's big, placid, humorous features wore, like all their faces, an expression of expectancy. It was generally true that the best stories were told here, in Sears's house. "Who's on the griddle tonight?" asked Lewis. But it was only courtesy, they all knew. The group, called the Chowder Society, had only a few rules. They wore evening clothes, because 30 years ago Sears had rather liked the idea. They never drank too much, and now they were too old for that anyhow. They never asked if any of the stories were true, since even the outright whoppers were in some sense true. And, though the stories went around the group in rotation, they never pressured anyone who had temporarily dried up. Hawthorne was about to confess when John Jaffrey interrupted. "I've been thinking," he said, and then responded to the other's inquisitive glances. "No, I know it's not me, and a good thing, too. But I was just thinking that in 2 weeks it will be a year to the day since Edward died. He'd be here tonight if I hadn't insisted on that damned party." "Please, John," said Ricky. He didn't like to look directly at Jaffrey's face when it showed his emotion so clearly. His skin looked like you could push a pencil straight through it and draw no blood. "All of us know that you were not to blame yourself." "But it happened in my house," insisted Jaffrey. "Calm down, Doc," Lewis said. "You're not doing yourself any good." "I'll decide that."
"Then you're not doing the rest of us any good," Lewis said with the same bland good humor. "We all remember the date. How could we forget?"
"Then what are you doing about it? Do you think you're acting as though it never happened, as though it was normal? Just some old poop kicking the bucket? Because if so, let me inform you that you're not."
He had shocked them into silence. Even Ricky could think of nothing to say. Jaffrey's face was gray.
"No," he said. "You're damned well not. You all know what's been happening to us. We sit around here and talk like a bunch of ghouls. Millie can hardly stand having us in my house anymore. We weren't always like this. We used to talk about all sorts of things. We used to have fun. We used to be fun. Now there isn't. We're all scared. But I don't know if some of you are admitting it. Well, it's been a year, and I don't mind saying that I am."
"I'm not so sure I'm scared," said Lewis. He took a sip of his whiskey and smiled at Jaffrey.
"You're not so sure you're not, either," snapped the doctor.
Sears James coughed into his fist, and everybody immediately looked at him. "My God," thought Ricky, "he can do that whenever he wants, just effortlessly capture our attention. I wonder why he ever thought he couldn't be a good teacher. And I wonder why I ever thought I could hold my own with him."
"John," Sears said gently, "we're all familiar with the facts. All of you were kind enough to go through the cold to come here tonight, and none of us are young men anymore. Let's continue."
"But Edward didn't die at your house, and that Moore woman, that so-called actress, didn't..."
"Enough of that," Sears commanded.
"Well, I suppose you remember how we got on this kick," said Jaffrey.
Sears nodded, and so did Ricky Hawthorne.
It had been at the first meeting after Edward Wanderley's odd death. The remaining four had been hesitant. They could not have been more conscious of Edward's absence had an empty chair been placed among them. Their conversation had stuttered and stalled through half a dozen false beginnings. All of them, Ricky had seen, were wondering if they could bear to continue to meet. Ricky knew that none of them could bear not to. And then he had had his inspiration. He had turned to John Jaffrey and said,
"What's the worst thing you've ever done?"
Dr. Jaffrey had surprised him by going pink, and then had set the tone of all their subsequent meetings by saying,
"I won't tell you that, but I'll tell you the worst thing that ever happened to me, the most dreadful thing,"
and following it by telling what was, in effect, a ghost story. It was riveting, surprising, frightening. It took their minds off Edward. They had gone on like that ever since.
"Do you really think it's just coincidence?" asked Jaffrey.
"Don't follow," Sears grumped.
"You're dissembling, and it's beneath you. I mean that we started on this tack, me first, after Edward."
His voice trailed off, and Ricky knew that he was caught between died and was killed.
"Went west,"
he put in, hoping for lightness of touch. Jaffrey's stony, lizard-like eye, darting at him, told him he'd failed. Ricky leaned back in the opulent chair, hoping to vanish into the luxurious background and be no more conspicuous than a water stain on one of Sears's old maps.
"Where did you get that from?" Sears asked, and Ricky remembered. It was what his father had used to say when a client died.
"Old Toby Pfaff went west last night. Mrs. Wintergreen went west this morning. There'll be devil to pay in the probate court."
He shook his head.
"Yes, that's right," Sears said. "But I don't know."
"Exactly," said Jaffrey. "I think something pretty damn funny is going on."
"What do you advise? I take it that you're not just talking for the sake of interrupting the proceedings."
Ricky smiled over the tops of his joined fingers to show that he took no offense.
"Well, I do have a suggestion."
He was doing his best, Ricky saw, to handle Sears carefully.
"I think we should invite Edward's nephew to come here."
"And what would be the point of that?"
"Isn't he by way of being an expert in this sort of thing?"
"What is this sort of thing?"
Pushed, Jaffrey did not back down.
"Maybe just what's mysterious. I think he could help us."
Sears was looking impatient, but the doctor did not let him interrupt.
"I think we need help. Or am I the only man here who has trouble getting a decent night's sleep? Am I the only one who has nightmares every night?"
He scanned them all with his sunken face.
"Ricky, you're an honest man." "You're not the only one, John," Ricky said.
"No, I suppose not," said Sears,
and Ricky looked at him in surprise. Sears had never indicated before that he, too, might have awful nights. Certainly it never showed on that big, smooth, reflective face.
"You have his book in mind, I imagine."
"Well, yes, of course. He must have done research. He must have had some experience."
"I thought his experience was of mental instability."
"Like us," Jaffrey said bravely. "Edward must have had some reason for willing his nephew his house. I think it was that he wanted Donald to come here. If anything should happen to him, I think he knew that something would happen. And I'll tell you what else I think. I think we ought to tell him about Eva Galley."
"Tell him an inconclusive story 50 years old? Ridiculous."
"The reason it's not ridiculous is that it is inconclusive," the doctor said.
Ricky saw that Lewis was as surprised, even shaken, as he, that Jaffrey had brought up the story of Eva Galley. That episode lay, as Sears had said, 50 years in their past. None of them had mentioned it since.
"Do you think you know what happened to her?" the doctor challenged.
"Hey, come on," Lewis put in. "Do we really need that? What the hell is the point?"
"The point is trying to find out what really happened to Edward. I'm sorry if that wasn't clear."
Sears nodded, and Ricky thought he could detect in his longtime partner's face a sign of
what? Relief?
Of course, he would not admit to it, but that it could be seen at all was a revelation to Ricky.
I'm in a little doubt about the reasoning, Sears said. But if it would make you happy, I suppose we could write to Edward's nephew. We have his address in our files, don't we, Ricky? Hawthorne nodded. But to be democratic, I'd like to put it to a vote first. Shall we just verbally agree or disagree and vote like that? What do you say?
He sipped from his glass and looked them over. They all agreed.
We'll start with you, John.
Of course I say yes. Send for him.
Lewis?
Lewis shrugged.
I don't care one way or the other. Send for him if you want.
That's a yes.
Okay, it's a yes. But I say don't drag up the Eva Galley business. Ricky?
Ricky looked at his partner and saw that Sears knew how he was going to vote.
No, definitely no. I think it's a mistake.
You'd rather have us go on as we have been going on for a year?
Change is always change for the worse.
Sears was amused.
Spoken like a true lawyer. Though I think the sentiment ill becomes the former member of YPSL. But I say yes, and that makes it 3-1. It's carried. We'll write to him. Since mine was the deciding vote, I'll handle it.
I've just thought of something, Ricky said. It's been a year now. Suppose he wants to sell the house. It's been sitting empty since Edward died.
Faw, you're inventing problems. We'll get him here faster if he wants to sell.
How can you be sure things won't get worse? Can you be sure?
Sitting as he had at least once a month for more than 20 years, in a coveted chair in the best room he knew, Ricky fervently wished that nothing would change, that they would be allowed to continue, and that they would simply tease out their anxieties and bad dreams and stories. Looking at them all in the lowered light, as a cold wind battered the trees outside Sears's windows, he wished for nothing more than that, to continue. They were his friends. He was, in a way, as married to them as a moment ago he had considered he was to Sears. And he gradually became aware that he feared for them. They seemed so terribly vulnerable, sitting there and regarding him quizzically, as if each of the others imagined that nothing could be worse than a few bad dreams and a biweekly spook story. They believed in the efficacy of knowledge. But he saw a plane of darkness cast by a lampshade cross John Jaffrey's forehead and thought, John is dying already. There is a kind of knowledge they have never confronted, despite the stories they tell. And when that thought came into his well-groomed little head, it was as though whatever was implied in the knowledge he meant was out there somewhere, out in the first signs of winter, out there and gaining on them. Sears said,
We've decided, Ricky. It's for the best. We can't just stew in our own juices. Now, he looked around the circle they made, metaphorically rubbing his hands, and said, Now that's settled. Who, as Lewis put it, is on the griddle tonight?
Within Ricky Hawthorne, the past suddenly shifted and delivered a moment so fresh and complete that he knew he had his story. Although he'd had nothing planned, and had thought he would have to pass. But 18 hours from the year 1945 shone clearly in his mind, and he said,
Well, I guess it's me.
2. After the other two had left, Ricky stayed behind, telling them that he was in no hurry to get out into that cold. Lewis had said,
It'll put blood in your cheeks, Ricky.
But Dr. Jaffrey had merely nodded. It really was unseasonably cold for October, cold enough for snow. Sitting alone in the library while Sears went off to freshen up their drinks,
Ricky could hear the ignition of Lewis's car grinding away in the street. Lewis had a Morgan, which he'd imported from England 5 years before, and it was the only sports car Ricky had really liked the looks of. But the canvas top wouldn't be much protection on a night like this. And Lewis seemed to be having a lot of trouble getting the car to start.
There. Oh, he'd nearly got it.
In these New York winters, you really needed something bigger than Lewis's little Morgan. Poor John would be frozen by the time Lewis got him home to Millie Sheehan and the big house on Montgomery Street, around the corner and seven blocks up. Millie'd be sitting in the semi-dark of the doctor's waiting rooms, keeping herself awake so that she could jump up as soon as she heard his key in the door, help him off with his coat, and pour a little hot chocolate into him. As Ricky sat listening, the Morgan's engine coughed into life. He heard them drive away and pictured Lewis clapping a hat on his head, grinning at John and saying, "Didn't I tell you this little beauty would perform?" After he'd dropped John off, he'd leave town altogether, zipping along Route 17 until he was out in the woods, and go back to the place he'd bought when he had returned. Whatever else Lewis had done in Spain, he had earned a lot of money. Ricky's own home was literally just around the corner, not a 5-minute walk away. In the old days, he and Sears had walked to their office in town every day. In warm weather, they sometimes still did. "Mutt and Jeff," Estella said. This was directed more at Sears than himself. Stella had never actually liked Sears. Of course, she had never let this submerged dislike interfere with her attempts to dominate him a little. There was no question that Stella would be waiting up with hot chocolate. She'd have gone to sleep hours ago, leaving only a hall light burning upstairs. It was Stella's conviction that if he was going to indulge himself at his friends' houses and leave her behind, he could knock around in the dark when he got home, bumping his knees on the glass and chrome modern furniture that she had made him buy. Sears came back into the room with two drinks in his hands and a freshly fired-up cigar in his mouth. Ricky said,
"Sears, you're probably the only person I know to whom I could admit that sometimes I wish I'd never got married."
"Don't waste your envy on me," Sears said. "I'm too old, too fat, and too tired."
"You're none of those things," he answered, accepting the drink Sears gave him. "You just have the luxury of being able to pretend you are."
"Oh, but you pulled out the prize plum," Sears said. "The reason you wouldn't say what you've just said to anyone else is that they'd be stupefied. Stella is a famous beauty, and if you said it to her, she'd brain you."
He sat back in the chair he'd occupied earlier, stretched his legs out and crossed them at the ankles.
"She'd slap a box together, dump you in it, bury you in 5 seconds flat, and then run off with an athletic 40-year-old, smelling of salt water and bay rum. The reason you can tell me is that—"
Sears paused, and Ricky feared that he'd say, "I sometimes wish you'd never married, too.
Is it that I am Or de Camba, or is it Or Khmer's?"
Listening to his partner's voice, holding his drink, Ricky thought of John Jaffrey and Louis Benedict speeding away to their houses, of his own redecorated house waiting, and was aware of how settled their lives were, of how much they had found a comfortable routine.
"Well, which is it?" Sears asked,
and he replied,
"Oh, in your case, Or de Camba, I'm sure,"
and smiled, stingingly aware of their closeness. He remembered what he had said before, "All change is change for the worse," and thought, "That's true, God help us." Ricky suddenly saw all of them, his old friends and himself, as on a fragile, invisible plane suspended high up in dark air.
"Does Stella know you have nightmares?" Sears asked.
"Well, I didn't know that you did," Ricky answered, as though it were a joke.
"I saw no reason to discuss it."
"And you've been having them for..." Sears leaned further into his chair.
"You've had yours for..."
"A year."
"And I, for a year. So have the other two, apparently."
"Lewis doesn't seem ruffled."
"Nothing ruffles Lewis. When the Creator made Lewis, he said, 'I am going to give you a handsome face, a good constitution, and an equable temperament. But because this is an imperfect world, I'll hold back a little on brains.' He got rich because he liked Spanish fishing villages, not because he knew what was going to happen to them."
Ricky ignored this. It was all part of the way Sears liked to characterize Lewis. "They started after Edward's death?"
Sears nodded his massive head.
"What do you think happened to Edward?"
Sears shrugged. They had all asked the question too many times.
"As you are surely aware, I know no more than you."
"Do you think we'll be any happier if we find out?"
"Goodness, what a question. I can't answer that one either, Ricky."
"Well, I don't. I think something terrible will happen to us. I think you'll bring down disaster on us if you invite that young Wanderley."
"Superstition," Sears grumbled. "Nonsense. I think something terrible has already happened to us. And this young Wanderley might be the man who can clear it up."
"Did you read his book?"
"The second one? I looked at it."
This was an admission that he had read it.
"What did you think?"
"A nice exercise in genre writing, more literary than most. Few nice phrases, reasonably well-constructed plot."
"But about his insights?"
"I think he won't immediately dismiss us as a bunch of old fools. That's the main thing."
"Oh, I wish he would," Ricky wailed. "I don't want anybody poking around in our lives. I want things just to keep on going."
"But it's possible that he will poke around, as you say, and end by convincing us that we are just spooking ourselves. Then maybe Jaffrey will stop scourging himself for that blasted party. He only insisted on it because he wanted to meet that worthless little actress, that Moore girl."
"I think about that party a lot," Ricky said. "I've been trying to remember when I saw her that night."
"I saw her," said Sears. "She was talking to Stella."
"That's what everybody says. Everybody saw her talking to my wife. But where did she go afterward?"
"You're getting as bad as John. Let's wait for young Wanderley. We need a fresh eye."
"I think we'll be sorry," said Ricky, trying for one last time. "I think we'll be ruined. We'll be like some animal eating its own tail. We have to put it behind us."
"It's decided. Don't be melodramatic."
So that was that. Sears could not be swayed. Ricky asked him about another of the things on his mind. "On our evenings, do you always know what you're going to say in advance when it's your turn?" Sears' eyes met his, marvelously, cloudlessly blue.
"Why?"
"Because I don't. Not most of the time. I just sit and wait, and then it comes to me. Like tonight. Is it that way with you?"
"Often. Not that it proves anything."
"Is it like that for the others, too?"
I see no reason why it shouldn't be. Now, Ricky, I want to get some rest, and you should go home. Stella must be waiting for you.
He couldn't tell if Sears were being ironic or not. He touched his bow tie. Bow ties were a part of his life, like the Chowder Society that Stella barely tolerated.
Where do these stories come from?
From our memories, Sears said. Or, if you prefer, from our doubtless Freudian unconsciouses. Come on, I want to be left alone. I have to wash all the glasses before I get to bed.
May I ask you one more time?
What now?
Not to write to Edward's nephew.
Ricky stood up, audacity making his heart speed.
You can be persistent, can't you? Certainly, you may ask. But by the time we get together again, he will already have my letter. I think it's for the best.
Ricky made a wry face, and Sears said,
Persistent without being aggressive.
It was very much like something Stella would have said. Then Sears startled him by adding,
It's a nice quality, Ricky.
At the door, Sears held his coat while he slipped his arms into the sleeves.
I thought John looked worse than ever tonight, Ricky said.
Sears opened the front door onto dark night, illuminated by the street lamp before the house. Orange light fell on the short, dead lawn and narrow sidewalk, both littered with fallen leaves. Massive dark clouds moved across the black sky. It felt like winter.
John is dying, Sears said unemotionally,
giving back to Ricky his own thought.
See you at Wheat Row. Give my regards to Stella.
Then the door closed behind him. A spruce little man, already beginning to shiver in the cold night air. Sears James. 1. They spent most days together at their office, but Ricky honored tradition by waiting until the meeting at Dr. Jaffrey's house to ask Sears the question that had been on his mind for 2 weeks.
Did you send the letter?
Of course, I told you I would.
What did you say to him?
What was agreed. I also mentioned the house and said that we hoped he would not decide to sell it without inspecting it first. All of Edward's things are still there, of course, including his tapes. If we haven't had the heart to go through them, perhaps he will.
They were standing apart from the other two, just inside the doorway to John Jaffrey's living rooms. John and Lewis were seated in Victorian chairs in a corner of the nearest room, talking to the doctor's housekeeper, Millie Sheehan, who sat on a stool before them, dangling a flowered tray which had held their drinks. Like Ricky's wife, Millie resented being excluded from the meetings of the Chowder Society. Unlike Stella Hawthorne, she perpetually hovered at the edges, popping in with bowls of ice cubes and sandwiches and cups of coffee. She irritated Sears to almost exactly the same extent as a summer fly bumping against the window. In many ways, Millie was preferable to Stella Hawthorne, less demanding, less driven. And she certainly took care of John. Sears approved of the women who helped his friends. For Sears, it was an open question whether or not Stella had taken care of Ricky. Now Sears looked down at the person fate had put closer to him than anyone else in the world, and knew that Ricky was thinking that he had weasel-worded his way out of the last question. Ricky's sagacious little jowls were taut with impatience.
All right, he said. I told him that we weren't satisfied with what we knew of his uncle's death. I did not mention Miss Galley.
Well, thank God for that, Ricky said, and walked across the room to join the others.
Millie stood up, but Ricky smiled and waved her back to the stool. A born gentleman, Ricky had always been charming to women. An armchair stood not 4 feet away, but he would not sit until Millie asked him to. Sears took his eyes off Ricky and looked around at the familiar upstairs sitting room. John Jaffrey had turned the whole ground floor of his house into his office, waiting rooms, consulting rooms, a drug cabinet. The other two small rooms on the ground floor were Millie's apartment. John lived the rest of his life up here, where there had been only bedrooms in the old days. Sears had known the interior of John Jaffrey's home for at least 60 years. During his childhood, he had lived two houses down on the other side of the street. That is, the building he had always thought of as the family house was there, to be returned to from boarding school, to be returned to from Cambridge. In those days, Jaffrey's house had been owned by a family named Fredrickson, who had two children much younger than Sears. Mr. Fredrickson had been a grain merchant, a crafty, beer-swilling, mountainous man with red hair and a redder face, sometimes mysteriously tinged blue. His wife had been the most desirable woman young Sears had ever seen. She was tall, with coiled long hair some color between brown and auburn, and had a kittenish, exotic face and prominent breasts. It was with these that young Sears had been fascinated. Speaking to Viola Fredrickson, he'd had to struggle to keep his eyes on her face. In the summers, home from boarding school and between trips to the country, he was their babysitter. The Fredricksons could not afford a full-time nanny, though a girl from the Hollow lived in their house as cook and maid. Possibly it amused Fredrickson to have Professor James's son babysit for his boys. Sears had his own amusements. He liked the boys and enjoyed their hero worship, which was so much like that of the younger boys at the Hill School. And once the boys were asleep, he enjoyed prowling through the house and seeing what he could find. He saw his first French letter in Abel Fredrickson's dresser drawer. He had known he was doing wrong entering the bedrooms where he now freely stood, but he could not keep himself from doing it. One night he had opened Viola Fredrickson's desk and found a photograph of her. She looked impossibly inviting, exotic and warm, an icon of the other, unknowable half of the species. He looked at the way her breasts pushed out the fabric of her blouse, and his mind filled with sensations of their weight, their density. He was so hard that his penis felt like the trunk of a tree. It was the first time that his sexuality had hit him with such force. Groaning, clutching his trousers, he had turned away from the photograph and seen one of her blouses folded on top of the dresser. He could not help himself. He caressed it. He could see where the blouse would bulge, carrying her within it. Her flesh seemed to be present beneath his hands, and he unbuttoned his trousers and took out his member. He placed it on the blouse, thinking with the part of his mind that could still think that it was making him do it. It was making him push its distended tip down where her breasts would cushion it. He groaned, bent double over the blouse. A convulsion went through him, and he exploded. His balls felt as if they'd been caught in a vice. Immediately after, shame struck him like a fist. He rolled the blouse up into his satchel of books and, going a roundabout way home, wrapped the once flawless thing around a stone and tossed it into the river. Nobody had ever mentioned the stolen blouse to him, but it was the last time he'd been invited to babysit. Through the windows behind Ricky Hawthorne's head, Sears could see a street lamp shining on the second floor of the house Eva Galley had bought when, on whatever whim or impulse, she had come to Millburn. Most of the time he could forget about Eva Galley and where she had lived. He supposed that he was conscious of it now, of her house shining at them through the window, because of some connection his mind made between her and the ridiculous scene he had just remembered. Maybe I should have cleared out of Milburn when I could, he thought. The bedroom where Edward Wanderley had died exactly a year ago was just overhead. By unspoken common agreement, none of them had alluded to the coincidence of their meeting here again on the anniversary of their friend's death. A fraction of Ricky Hawthorne's sense of doom flickered in his mind, and then he thought, "You old fool, you still feel guilty about that blouse." Huh? 2. "It's my turn tonight," Sears said, relaxing as well as he could into Jaffrey's largest armchair and making sure he was facing away from the old galley house. "And I want to tell you about certain events that happened to me when I was a young man, experimenting with the profession of teaching in the country around Elmira. I say experimenting because even then, at the beginning of my first year, I had no certainty that I was destined for that profession. I signed a 2-year contract, but I didn't think they could hold me to it if I wanted to leave. Well, one of the most dreadful things in my life happened to me there. Or it didn't happen, and I imagined it all, but anyhow, it scared the pants off me and eventually made it impossible for me to stay on. This is the worst story I know, and I've kept it locked up in my mind for 50 years. You know what a schoolmaster's duties were in those days. This was no urban school, and it was no hill school either. God knows that was where I should have applied, but I had a number of elaborate ideas in those days. I fancied myself as a real country Socrates, bringing the light of reason into the wilderness. Wilderness. In those days, the country around Elmira was nearly that, as I remember. But now there isn't even a suburb where the little town was. A freeway cloverleaf was put up right over the site of the school. The whole thing's under concrete. It used to be called Four Forks, and it's gone. But back then, during my sabbatical from Milburn, it was a typical little village, 10 or 12 houses, a general store, post office, a blacksmith, a schoolhouse. All of these buildings looked alike in a general sort of way. They were all wooden. They hadn't been painted in years, so they all looked a bit gray and dismal. The schoolhouse was one room, of course, one room for all 8 grades. When I came up for my interview, I was told that I'd be boarding with the Mathers. They'd put in the lowest bid, and I soon found out why, and that my day would start at 6. I had to chop the wood for the schoolhouse stove, get a good fire going, sweep the place out and get the books in place, pump up the water, clean the boards, wash the windows, too, when they needed it. Then, at 7:30, the students would come. And my job was to teach all 8 grades, reading, writing, arithmetic, music, geography, penmanship, history, the works. Now I'd run a mile from any such prospect. But then I was full of Abraham Lincoln on one end of a log and Mark Hopkins on the other, and I was bursting to start. The whole idea simply enraptured me. I was besotted. I suppose even then the town was dying, but I couldn't see it. What I saw was splendor. Freedom and splendor. A little tarnished, perhaps, but splendor all the same. You see, I didn't know. I couldn't guess what most of my pupils would be like. I didn't know that most country school teachers in these little hamlets were boys of about 19, with no more education than they'd be giving. I didn't know how muddy and unpleasant a place like Four Forks would be most of the year. I didn't know I'd be half-starved most of the time, nor that it would be a condition of my job that I report for church every Sunday, off in the next village, an 8-mile hike. I didn't know how rough it would be. I began to find out when I went over to the Mathers with my suitcase that first night. Charlie Mather used to be the postmaster in town, but when the Republicans got into office, they made Howard Hummel the postmaster, and Charlie Mather never got over his resentment. He was permanently sour. When he took me up to the room I was to use, I saw that it was unfinished. The floor was plain, unsanded wood, and the ceiling consisted of just the roofing joists and tiles. "Was making this for our daughter," Mather told me. "She died, one less mouth to feed." The bed was a tired old mattress on the floor with one old army blanket over it. In the winter, there wasn't enough warmth for an Eskimo in that room. But I saw that it had a desk and a kerosene lamp, and I was still seeing stars, and I said, "Fine, I'll love it here," something to that effect. Mather grunted in disbelief as well he might. Supper that night was potatoes and creamed corn. "You'll eat no meat here," Mather said, "unless you save up and buy it yourself. I'm getting the allowance to keep you alive, not to fatten you up." I don't suppose I ate meat more than 6 times at the Mather table, and that was all at once when somebody gave him a goose, and we had goose every day until there was nothing left of it. Eventually, some of my pupils began bringing me ham and beef sandwiches. Their parents knew Mather was a mean-fisted man. Mather himself ate his big meal at noon, but he made it clear that it was my duty to spend the lunch hour in the schoolhouse, offering extra help and giving punishments. Because up there they believed in the birch. I'd taught my first day when I found out about that. I say taught, but really all I'd managed to do was keep them quiet for a few hours and write down their names and ask a few questions. It was astonishing. Only 2 of the older girls could read. Simple addition and subtraction was as far as their math went, and not only had a few of them not heard of foreign countries, one of them didn't even believe they existed.
"Oh, there's nothing like that," one scrawny 10-year-old told me. "A place where people ain't even American, where they don't even talk American?"
But he couldn't go further. He was laughing too hard at the absurdity of the idea, and I saw a mouthful of appalling blackened teeth.
"So what about the war, dopey?" another boy said. "Never heard tell of the Germans?"
Before I could react, the first boy flew over the desk and started beating the second boy. It looked as though he was literally set on murdering him. I tried to separate the 2 boys. The girls were all shrieking, and I grabbed the assailant's arm.
"He's right," I said. "He shouldn't have called you a name, but he is right. Germans are the people who live in Germany, and the World War—" I stopped short, because the boy was growling at me. He was like a savage dog. And for the first time I realized that he was mentally disturbed, perhaps retarded. He was ready to bite me.
"Now, apologize to your friend," I said.
"Ain't no friend of mine."
"Apologize."
"He's queer, sir,"
the other boy said. His face was pale, and his eyes were frightened, and he had the beginnings of a black eye.
"I should never have said that to him."
I asked the first boy what his name was.
"Fenny Bate,"
he managed to drool out. He was calming down. I sent the second boy back to his desk. Fenny, I said, the trouble is that you were wrong. America isn't the whole world, just as New York isn't the whole United States. This was too complicated, and I had lost him. So I brought him up to the front and made him sit down while I drew maps on the board. Now, this is the United States of America, and this is Mexico, and this is the Atlantic Ocean. Fenny was shaking his head darkly.
Lies, he said. Oh, that's lies. That stuff ain't there. It ain't!
When he shouted, he pushed at his desk and it went crashing over. I asked him to pick up his desk, and when he just shook his head, started to slobber again, I picked it up myself. Some of the children gasped. So you've seen or heard of maps and other countries? I asked. He nodded.
But they're lies.
Who told you that? He shook his head and refused to say. If he had shown any signs of embarrassment, I would have thought that he'd learned this misinformation from his parents. But he did not. He was just angry and sullen. At noon, all the children took their paper bags outside and ate their sandwiches in the lot around the school. It would be window dressing to call it a playground. Though there was a rickety set of swings in back of the school. I kept my eye on Fenny Bate. He was left alone by most of the other children. When he roused himself from his stupor and tried to join a group, the others pointedly walked away and left him standing alone, his hands in his pockets. From time to time, a skinny girl with lank blonde hair came up and spoke to him. She rather resembled him, and I imagined that she must have been his sister. I checked my lists. Constance Bate, in the 5th grade. She had been one of the quiet ones. Then, when I looked back at Fenny, I saw an odd-looking man standing on the road outside the building, looking across the school grounds at him, just as I was doing. Fenny Bate was sitting unaware between us. For some reason, this man gave me a shock. It was not just that he was odd in appearance, though he was that, dressed in old, disreputable working clothes with wild black hair, ivory cheeks, a handsome face, and extremely powerful-looking arms and shoulders. It was the way he was looking at Fenny Bate. He looked feral, and with the wildness there was a striking sort of freedom in the way he stood there, a freedom that went deeper than mere self-assurance. To me he seemed extremely dangerous, and it seemed that I had been transported into a region where men and boys were wild beasts in disguise. I looked away almost frightened by the savagery in the man's face, and when I looked back, he was gone. My notions of the place were confirmed that evening, when I had forgotten all about the man outside on the road. I had gone upstairs to my drafty room to try to work out my lessons for the 2nd day. I would have to introduce the multiplication tables to the upper grades. They all could use some extremely elementary geography. Things of this sort were going through my mind when Sophronia Mather entered my room. The first thing she did was to turn down the kerosene lamp I had been using.
"That's for full dark, not evening," she said. "We can't afford to have you using up all the kerosene. You'll learn to read your books by the light God gives you."
I was startled to see her in my room. During supper the previous evening, she had been silent, and judging by her face, which was pinched and sallow and tight as a drumhead, you would say that silence was her natural mode. She made it very expressive, I can tell you, but I was to learn that apart from her husband she had no fear of speech.
"'I've come to quiz you, schoolteacher,'
she said.
"'There's been talk.'
"'Already?' I asked.
"'You make your endings in your manner of beginning, "'and how you begin is how you'll go on. "'I've heard from Mariana Birdwood "'that you tolerate misbehavior in your classes.'
"'I don't believe I did,' I said.
"'Her Ethel claims you did.'
I could not put a face to the name Ethel Birdwood, but I remembered calling it out. She was one of the older girls, the 15-year-olds, I thought. And what does Ethel Birdwood claim I tolerated?
It's that Fenny Bate. Didn't he use fists on another boy right in front of your nose?
I spoke to him.
Spoke? Speaking's no good. Why didn't you use your ferule?
I don't possess one, I said. Now she really was shocked.
But you must beat them, she finally got out. It's the only way. You must ferule one or two every day, and Fenny Bate more than the rest.
Why particularly him?
Because he is bad.
I saw that he is troubled, slow, disturbed. I said, but I don't think that I saw that he was bad.
He is. He is bad. And the other children expect him to be beaten. If your ideas are too uppity for us, then you'll have to leave the school. It's not only the children who expect you to use the ferule.
She turned as if to go out.
I thought I would do you the kindness of speaking to you before my husband hears that you have been neglecting your duties. Mind you, you'll take my advice. There's no teaching without beating.
But what makes Fenny Bates so notorious? I asked, ignoring that horrific last remark. It would be unjust to persecute a boy who needs help.
The ferule's all the help he needs. He's not bad, he's badness itself. You should make him bleed and keep him quiet. Keep him down. I'm only trying to help you, schoolmaster. We have use of the little extra money your allowance brings us.
With that, she left me. I did not even have time to ask her about the peculiar man I had seen that afternoon. Well, I had no intention of doing further damage to the town's scapegoat. Millie Sheehan, her face puckered with distaste, set down the ashtray she had been pretending to polish, glanced at the window to make sure the drapes were closed, and edged around the door. Sears, pausing in his story, saw that she had left it open a crack. 3. Sears James, pausing in his story, and thinking with annoyance that Millie's eavesdropping was becoming less subtle every month, was unaware of an event which had occurred that afternoon in town and would affect all of their lives. This was unremarkable in itself, the arrival of a striking young woman on a Trailways bus, a young woman who stepped out of the bus on the corner of the bank and the library and looked around with an expression of confident satisfaction, like that of a successful woman returning for a nostalgic look at her hometown. That was what she suggested, holding a small suitcase in her hand and smiling slightly in a sudden fall of brilliant leaves. And you would have said, watching her, that her success was the measure of her revenge. She looked, with her long, handsome coat and her abundance of dark hair, as if she had come back to rejoice discreetly over how far she had come, as if that were half the pleasure she felt. Millie Sheehan, out shopping for the doctor's groceries, saw her standing by the stop as the bus rolled away toward Binghamton and thought for a moment that she knew her, as did Stella Hawthorne, who was having a cup of coffee beside the window of the Village Pump restaurant. Still smiling